This is the Jazz Rocks Podcast, where the past, present, and future of jazz fusion lives. Here are musician and radio personality Tom Alexander and author and musicologist Walter Koloski.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Jazz Rocks Podcast. My name is Tom Alexander, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Walter Koloski. Hey, Walter.
Hey, Tom. Because of circumstances, we're not doing as many shows as we'd like to.
Yeah.
But we're going to continue to make the effort.
We are making the effort. Always got to keep the jazz, rock fusion moving, man.
Yeah. In your case, every Friday, you do a little something special. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. Friday Fusion. I do. It's funny because I actually used to do a show in college radio called Friday Fusion. And 3 hours of fusion jazz from 1 to 4. So today I'm continuing. I think I'm in my, as we're recording this, I should say, I'm in my like 15th week of doing every Friday at 4 o'clock. And it's a lot of fun. And I get to set up my keyboards in the isolation room and play original fusion, world music, jazz, and just kind of whatever comes to mind. And you know, it's been fun. Gotten some wonderful feedback from people checking it out.
I try to catch it every week. In fact, it many times caps the week for me, believe it or not. As my co-host does his Friday Fusion.
Thank you.
I have mentioned to you when moments of brilliance pop up, I post it right away, and there have been quite a few of those.
Thank you.
I really recommend those of us who are into fusion music, which would include everyone listening right now. I really recommend you try to listen to that. That's only on Facebook?
Yeah, right now it's just on Facebook. We do the Facebook Live thing, and it's 4 o'clock Eastern time for our viewers, listeners, around the world, no matter where you're listening. It's 4 o'clock Eastern U.S. time. So do the math on your time zones, and you can check it out. Of course, if you don't catch it live, you can always catch it on the archive. It is archived, so you can watch it anytime after its initial airing, if we can use that term.
Do you have to be a Facebook friend to listen?
No, you know, I think I'm pretty sure my site, my page, I should say, is public. So anybody can check it out. I don't think you have to have a...
You spell out your whole name, though, Thomas, right?
Yeah, it is Thomas C. Alexander. And I think, so you'll find me there. If there may be a couple other Thomas C. Alexanders out there on Facebook, but you'll see a little picture of me. I'm playing a keyboard, so you'll know. And the guy with the white hair, and that's me. So
the guy with the white hair and the hot licks.
The hot licks. Well, we try. So sometimes we crash and burn on some of those hot licks, but we keep trying, right?
Speaking of hot licks.
Yes, sir.
We recently interviewed guitarist, composer, educator, student, historian, Steve Kahn.
Yeah, Steve Kahn, one of my favorite guitarists. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, he's been around for a lot of years and he's played on a lot of great albums, including some of his own, you know, as a leader, and terrific stuff. And he's got great new music right now. Just he's continuing to churn it out.
Yeah, his latest is called Patchwork, and we did end up talking about that. We talked to Steve for a very long time. We cannot include everything.
Yeah.
We cannot include everything in today's show. But one of the interesting things we talked about at length was that he sees himself as coming in as part of the second wave of fusion guitarists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because we talk about, you know, how many waves of fusion are there really? But, you know, obviously the first wave, you know who's in that list. Go ahead. I mean, you can name.
I think, and by the way, we talked specifically about guitarists, and some of that conversation is left in, but not all of it. But I do think that they sort of go together. Mm-hmm. I think that the first wave of fusion and the second wave of fusion go together with the first wave of guitarists and the second wave.
Yeah, they kind of overlap in some ways, too, because some of the first wave guys would bring in some of the second wave guys as guests on their albums. You get two guitars going in some cases and different things, and they'd wind up open. One would open up for another or that kind of. So it started to you know, as it, the music evolved, that's kind of what happened.
We had McLaughlin and Coryell as obvious first wave members. Yeah. Steve brought up Bill Connors.
Yeah, I love Bill Connors.
Who has sort of disappeared in history because he sort of disappeared for whatever reason. But he talked at length about him. We couldn't include that, but wanted to mention it and how important he thought Bill was.
Yep.
And he was. And that was part of that first wave. And part of the second wave, well, who would you have in mind for part of the second wave of guitarists?
Yeah, so fusion guitarist second wave, for me, three guys that I have would be, well, Pat Metheny. And, you know, and people might question, you know, fusion in the traditional sense, but it certainly, you know, incorporated electronics and synthesizers and different things and a kind of a brought in more of a world music feel to it in many ways and Midwestern feel. But Metheny for sure came in, you know, mid-70s. Steve Morse, just around the same time with the Dixie Dregs and sort of took the spirit of Mahavishnu into a different direction. And my third guy came a little bit later, just a little bit later, but initially as a guest guitarist and band members, but then his own band, Scott Henderson. It'd be my third guy who was just, you know, tremendous.
I don't know that Steve Kahn would consider him a contemporary and part of this second wave. I don't know. And I think partially because Steve might be talking about sort of New York area based musicians when he talks, and our listeners will hear that later. You know, he mentions Abercrombie, which I would mention too. And there's also, I don't think he talked Larry Carlton or Lee Ritenour, mm-hmm. though they were West Coast players. And I'm wondering if he considered them contemporaries. Maybe next time we talk, we'll ask.
Right.
But those would be it.
Those now, be, I happen Al DiMeola is another one, possibly.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I happen to think that the good players in the second wave, they were there to try to help save fusion music. I think Steve Kahn did a yeoman's job of that when I heard those first albums under his own name. I thought that was during a fusion swan song, and I said, oh, here's some promise. Here's some promise.
Well, it's interesting because you and I do have differing opinions on this. I know that we've talked about this in the past and we'll share it with the audience. You know, you kind of felt that 74 was a pivotal year and that you thought somewhat of the music was starting to lose it. And I thought 74 was a pivotal year, but for the opposite reason. I thought things were starting to really happen because, and I'll give you a couple specifics. Two albums in particular came out in that year that I thought were absolutely fantastic, and they were Mysterious Traveler by Weather Report. And Thrust by the Headhunters, Herbie Hancock and the Headhunters. Those two albums for me were major, major, major albums. So, but I'm real interested in hearing what it was specifically about that year that was sort of pivotal for you the other way.
So to me, of course, those could be outliers. I'm not suggesting there weren't great fusion albums.
Right.
I think what I would tell our listeners is the difference between you and me was that I was living it and you were not. You know, I was old enough at that point that I was living during that time period and very aware of what was going on and the choices I had and was starting to hear things in the music that I didn't like, which was, you know, what I'd call a dumbing down or a commercialization.
Right.
And some players headed in that direction and some players didn't.
Yeah.
74, still, obviously, still a great year, and 75, still a great year, but there were hints. If I had to pick the year that I thought it started going downhill, it would be 1976. Again, it's very
subjective. Well, it's
subjective.
Got a little disco-fied, too. And I mean,
yeah,
I,
it's subjective in my part. And, of course, the music started to change, too, in the sense that toward the end of the decade, things started going acoustic again. believe it or not, if you start to think about what was going on, which was okay with some cases, you know, right. Shakti, you know, was 76 or thereabouts, 77. Guitar trio, but there was a lot of acoustic music coming out. Rock music started coming out in 1980, acoustic with MTV. What was the name of that show? Unplugged.
Oh, Unplugged, yeah.
Unplugged. And then the synthesizers started coming in and affected jazz rock again, and you had a lot of synthesizer-type music, synthesized drums and whatnot in the 80s. Again, there's good music during all this time. When I talk about fusion music, it's the genre and not particularly the musicians or the music itself. It's the genre as a whole, the commercial viability of it.
Yeah.
Where in the early 70s, you had so many choices to go out and hear some new, interesting, popular fusion music. And as the decade progressed, that became an opportunity you saw less and less and less.
Yeah.
Again, Steve Kahn, by the way, Steve Kahn is, I mean, he continued to play great music during that period. It's just that the fusion genre as a whole had shrunk.
Right.
So fewer people were going to listen to it. And I think he references that a little bit in the conversation later.
Yeah.
You know, the economic success of his career. But the point with Steve Kahn, though, and we'll talk a little bit after the interview, is his legacy.
Right.
He's a very important player because he's continued to play, and he continues to disseminate not just music, but knowledge about the music. I think he's a very important player from that aspect. We'll talk a little bit about his decision to attempt to make guitar an important voice in Latin music, which is what he's been doing the last decade or so, which is also important. But we talked to Steve for a long time.
Yeah,
so we have a lot of Steve Kahn to listen to. I think we should get to it. So after the birds, we're going to hear from Steve Kahn.
I'm Walter Kolosky, music journalist and co-host of the popular Jazz Rocks podcast. I know great fusion music when I hear it, and I hear it in all of its glory on the latest album from Electrio. Electrio is a power trio that possesses both a wild abandon and a structural foundation. Its music is a bundle of rawness, impulsive rhythms, changing textures, and deep themes. Electrio is Chris Dixon on guitar, Randy Tugas on bass, and Gary Arzab on drums and percussion. Your ears need Electrio. Available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Gary Husband, and you're listening to the Jazz Rocks podcast with Tom Alexander and Walter Kolosky.
From Steve Kahn's The Blue Man, this is Daily Bulls. Guitarist Steve Kahn is the son of one of the most famous pop lyricists and songwriters America ever produced, Sammy Kahn. Though Steve would change the spelling of his last name to K-H-A-N, he has carried on that family legacy into other forms of music. In the early 70s, as part of the second wave of fusion guitarists, as he describes it, Steve performed and recorded with Larry Coryell, the Brecker Brothers, and many more jazz and rock artists. In 1977, Steve began releasing albums under his own name, Tightrope and The Blue Man, made immediate impact on the jazz rock scene. Over the years, his growth as a musician, historian, and teacher, via his website, have continued. Over the last decade, Steve has focused on Latin jazz and has become what many consider to be the most preeminent guitar player in that genre. We had a little bit of an audio problem with the first question and answer until Steve found the source of the interference in his studio. He fixed it, and the sound gets better from there. We asked Steve to tell us about the beginnings and the symbiotic nature of his work with the visual artist Jean-Michel Fallon.
I was, you know, working a lot recording around New York, and the old A&R studios on Broadway, I'm sorry, 7th Avenue, 799 7th Avenue, which is now the Equitable Life Building, really ugly compared to the Shrine to Music that existed seven floors up. As I would come down the elevator out to the street, right next to A&R was one of those art galleries, poster art galleries. And you know, I started to see the work of this artist. I didn't know who it was, and I immediately responded to it. It was Jean-Michel's posters. And so at the time, the apartment that I had moved into, I had nothing on the walls. I didn't even know, I suppose, who I was to begin with. You know, like, what is my taste in art? What is my furniture? Nothing. I mean, I went, all I had was my guitars and my stereo stuff and a bed. As I'm reconstituting my life, I started to buy these posters, and I started like putting them up all over the place. That in part was the, you know, kind of an emotional, spiritual connection to the artwork. But then, lucky me, I get signed by Columbia in 1977. And idiot that I was at the time, I thought, well, this is great. Here I am. I'm at Columbia Records. I'm going to be, and I don't mean this literally, of course, I'm going to be like Miles Davis. I'll be here for 20, 30 years. I'll just, you know, every 18 months, I'll get to make a record. I'll go out on tour. I'll do all this stuff. And life's going to be great. Of course, that's not the way things worked out. When I did the first record, Tightrope, I went to meet with the art director, Paula Scheer. Paula said to me, she says, well, do you have any ideas for the cover? And I said, well, can I ask for anything I want? She says, well, you can ask. And I said, well, what about Jean-Michel Fallon? And she smiled and she says, oh, that's great. She says, I know his agent, John Locke. I said, this is great. And so those three albums for Columbia, Tightrope, The Blue Man and Arrows, all had original watercolors by Jean-Michel. One of them I have here. I don't think I'm supposed to have it, but I have the original watercolor for Tightrope. During somewhere, I guess around Arrows, so after Blue Man, maybe 78, 79, Jean-Michel was here for an exhibit, and we actually got to meet personally, and he came over with his girlfriend, wife, Paula, and we just had a wonderful time together, and this started, you know, a friendship that lasted up until the point you know, where he passed away. And it continued with Paula, which is why I still had covers by him, even though he had passed away. And the nice thing is that there have been people who've been drawn to his artwork because of my recordings, which is really wonderful for me. I mean, that's, you know, kind of the way it should work. After the first three covers, which, like I said, I mean, Columbia could pay for things, so they could do that. But after that, all the covers are really pieces of art that were used previously, like for a magazine or for, you know, something else. So I just picked ones that I felt resonated with, say, the title of whatever the recording was going to be. And over the years, I've only received, it doesn't mean people haven't thought this, but I've only received one, like, negative, if you can call it a fan mail, from somebody about the music and the artwork. And some guy, I forget where he was from, but it was in the U.S., and he said, Dear Mr. Khan, I'm writing to tell you that your work is not the musical equivalent of a Jean-Michel Fallon painting. It is absolutely nice. His world is a quiet world, a peaceful world, and your world is loud and noisy and frantic. And I say in general, I get wonderful correspondence from people, you know, about how they discovered Fallon through my recordings.
Now, we talk about your use of Jean-Michel Fallon on the album covers, and obviously the consistency there, but also consistency with the musicians that have played on your recordings over the years as well. The Breckers, Dennis Chambers, Bobby Allende, Mark Quiñones, Bob Mincer, many others, and even had ex-Mavishnu bassist Rick Laird come in to do some photography. How important is the use of the cadre of musicians and or friends to attaining your vision? Is it really all about playing music with your friends, creating a project with your friends?
Yes, absolutely. I think if all of us had our druthers, you know, we'd always be making a recording, going on tour with our favorite players. And sometimes those favorite players are favorite people to us too. Sometimes it's not. You know, sometimes you're playing with somebody and you don't get along that great outside of music. That's happened many times too. But the musical connection is so strong, you put up with the other crap that, you know, goes with it.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about the way my career has unfolded, where recordings are concerned, is that I seem to like, this was true for a while, I go through these things where I seem to make records in groups of three. So you had the three Columbia records, for example, you know, Tightrope, The Blue Man, and Arrows. And on those records, you had Steve Gadd, Will Lee, Don Grolnick, Michael and Randy Brecker, David Sanborn, Ralph McDonald. You had a kind of a family of players. And it stayed consistent. The sound stayed consistent. You know, the music grew in its way. But it was essentially an extension of how I heard the original Brecker Brothers band, just a little more guitar-centric. Then when we got to the early part of the 80s, and I formed a group called Eyewitness with Anthony Jackson, Steve Jordan, and Manolo Bedrena, we made three records together. And to tell you the truth, if things had, you know, worked out differently, and they often don't, but I'd still be making records with those three guys today if that was meant to be. But it, you know, sadly it wasn't. So that was really a really important, maybe the most important musical period of my life. Then when you go on, because you can go on later, there was Public Access in 89 with where Steve Jordan was off doing other things. So Dave Weckl came in and played with Anthony and Manolo and me. And a lot of people heard that record because at the time I licensed it to GRP and it just went all over the world, which had never, in the CD era, had never happened to me since I was with Columbia. Then after that, there were a couple of records with Ron Carter and Al Foster. And then back, that's where Dennis enters the picture. And so we have Headline, Crossings with Dennis, and of course, all the stuff later. And then in 96, I was doing something different after playing on the road a lot with acoustic bass and drums. And so I wanted to, you know, combine all of this with my experimentation with Latin jazz. And so then there was a record with Patitucci, DeJohnette, Bobby Allende, Mark Quiñones, Don Elias. Cafe was on it. That was called Got My Mental, and that was in 96. I didn't record again as a leader for 10 years. And not because I didn't want to, it's just nobody was interested. And that was a really, painful period for me, because there's no way to explain how hurtful it is when the business finds you to be, deems you to be irrelevant, more or less. After that, I went and did some stuff with Dave Samuels and Dave Valentine. Dave Samuels was going to reform the Caribbean Jazz Project, and I was on tour with them for a number of years between 99 and 2002. And that was a really great experience, because that sort of paves the way for the records that were to come, where I really found what I could do using the guitar as one of the primary voices in Latin jazz. But then nothing happened. Then in 2002, in 2005, we start the run of records that goes to the present. So, but they're all, there's really, ended up doing three records with Patitucci and DeJohnette and other people around. But see what I mean is there's like these things in threes. It's not planned. It's just an accident, but yeah. It's kind of goofy.
Steve Kahn albums and deaths both come in threes.
Yes, and bad things come in threes.
Our conversation with Steve Kahn will continue in a moment.
This is Jan Hammer. You are listening to Jazz Rocks podcast with Tom Alexander and Walter Goloski.
Mahatmosphere is a power fusion band that melds molten rock from the Earth's swirling core with the deep organic roots from its crust. The result? Beautiful Dirt. Beautiful Dirt is both zen and grunge, presented with a cinematic thrust. It is as compelling as any progressive music heard today. Mahatmosphere is Marco Anderson on drums, Mark Lawrence on guitar, and Al Swanger on bass. The best place to get Beautiful Dirt is on Bandcamp at Mahatmosphere, MAHATMOSPHERE.bandcamp.com, MAHATMOSPHERE.bandcamp.com. Follow Mahatmosphere on Facebook. Beautiful Dirt. Beautiful Dirt. Beautiful Dirt.
Stephen, it's hard to believe, but we met each other on the internet now about 15 years ago when I was doing the Power, Passion, and Beauty of Mahavishnu book. And for that book, you gave me some great stories about seeing Mahavishnu in their first ever live performance at the Gaslight down in the Village.
Yes.
If people want to hear about that, they can go read the book. That's a plug. But you had told me at the time that the reason you went was that there was a buzz around in the community that something great was going to be happening down in the Village at the Gaslight. What was going on in the neighborhood in which you lived, or the area in which you lived, that you knew something great was happening?
Well, at that time, 71 was when that happened. And I was still living uptown. This is before meeting my son's mother, before having my son, before moving downtown. So, my life then was actually where I now ended up, living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And, I was sleeping at friends' places and stuff. During that time, I'd already, met Mike and Randy Brecker and a ton of other guys. And we were all part of this organization that was founded by Dave Liebman, called Free Life Communications. And, what it was supposed to be was a forum for musicians of like minds to get together, share their music, get together and jam and do things, put on concerts. I remember Dave used to get up there at the beginning of a meeting and, you know, he'd say, I read a great book this week. And, you know, he'd talk about, you know, the book that he'd read. When you're in an organization like that, and just about every great player you can think of who was to become a great player, already was a great player, might have been a great player, was in there, all of them. And so we all talked to each other. And so, of course, you know, Michael and Randy had been, with Billy Cobham as part of Dreams. So they were very close. And you know, Randy had been with Billy, with Horace Silver. So there were you know, deep connections to that. Everybody knew Jan Hammer. And everybody, you know, I remember when Jan had, I think he replaced Chick with Sarah Vaughan or something. I mean, everybody knew Jan was in this, on this other level of, you know, he was a tremendous player. I mean, nothing could stop him. And I remember seeing Jan's band with Jeremy Steig and Eddie Gomez. Was it? No, I'm sorry. Gene Perla and Don Elias. So, I mean, that was an incredible band. You know, people talk to each other. When, after all the legendary stuff with Miles that John McLaughlin obviously was a huge part of, you know, everybody was kind of interested in, like, well, okay, you know, what's John going to do? What is John's music? And so, you know, and nobody really knew. I mean, people had heard Extrapolation, and they knew, you know, they knew some of maybe they'd heard My Goals Beyond then, but we, you know, nobody knew what it was going to be. So when I heard about this gig at the Gaslight, I just went. And it's not like me to go places by myself, but I don't think I went with anybody else. And like I told you, I mean, I went there and I sat there, and, you know, it was just an amazing thing to hear, because there was such a clear vision of, this is what we do, this is what we're going to be doing, this is the kind of music we're going to play, you know, bam, you know, and there it was. Nothing stopped them. So, you know, I just walked away from it realizing, I had heard something that was probably going to, you know, change our music. You know, speaking of the us as a community.
Steve, you were totally surrounded by music when you were growing up, and you could have taken many different directions, and perhaps you did. But if you were to pinpoint something, one thing that made you most interested in jazz, and I guess improvisational music in general, what was it?
Well, of all things, you know, I guess we all have a funny path to get to this wonderful music that we all are involved in one way or another. Mine was really strange. I was a really bad drummer, and I somehow got into, after my first high school bands, I somehow got into a really wonderful band, a great surfing band called the Shantays, who had a hit record, Pipeline. But I got in after they had this hit record. And so, yeah, I was going on the road with them and touring as a kid, as a high school kid. And so, but those guys, the two guitar players, Bob Spickard and Brian Carman, you know, they were a lot bigger than just surfing music. And Bob, he's the first guy that played me Wes Montgomery. And the first record he played me was Boss Guitar. And he played me a lot of other things. And playing with his band, I'm a high school kid, and I'm making, like, my own money. And so one of the first things I bought was a real stereo, my own stereo, with components, you know, two speakers, an amp, a turntable. And it opened up this world that, needless to say, I've never left. And in those days, you know, of course, buying an LP was only like $2. So I could take a 20, ride my bicycle down into Westwood Village, and buy 20 LPs. And you know how it is when you're a jazz fan, you buy one record and you hear, oh, here's this guy, Herbie Hancock. I wonder what he does. And then next thing you know, you're buying everything he did. You know, oh, Miles Davis. Well, okay, again. it's, you know, one thing just mushrooms into something else. And so that's where it really all started.
Steve, you've described yourself as being part of the second wave of fusion guitar players. Tell us a little bit about what you feel the second wave is, was, and where it's all going.
If we lump, you know, John and Larry historically together as the first wave of guys, then you have the guys that I arrived to town with, just coincidentally, which, you know, is providence for me. But I'm here with, you know, Ralph Towner, with John Abercrombie. John and I came at the same time. Sko came a little afterwards. And for Sko's first gig in New York, he borrowed my amp. So, you know, all of us were very, very connected and you know, we're good friends then and, you know, still good friends. I mean, you know, yes, I think we're all competitive in our way. You know, I love those guys, you know, and I admire them. You know, what I was going to say before, which I hope kind of ties all of this together, like going back to, you know, years of inspiration. And for me, like where the guitar was concerned, it was, you know, Wes and Kenny Burrell and Jim Hall and Grant Green. Going back to the mid 60s to the, you know, early 70s, you know, there's no real book. There's no, you know, music videos. There's no self-help internet. There's no nothing.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, you have your ears and you just transcribe stuff. And so that's what I started to do. And when I came to New York, with these 7 notebooks completely filled with all the tunes that I'd been listening to, all the Blue Note stuff, trying to write out the Miles stuff, which nobody had, you know, all of that music anywhere. You had to do it yourself. And so now, as I said, we come together, this bunch of players, you know, Free Life Communications, Liebman, Steve Grossman, Mike Brecker, everybody, Richie Bayrack. I mean, it'd take me an hour to list all the guys who were in it. Suddenly, I remember the first time I went over to Mike Brecker's, and I see this this round table. He was living like in squalor. On his table, one circular table, all there was reeds and mouthpieces, just forever, and. But there were these notebooks on there. And I said to him, I said, Mike, what's that? He said, oh, it's just my books, the transcriptions. I said, can I look? He said, sure. And I looked at these things, and it was like meeting someone who'd been in a parallel universe, more or less the same as me, except obviously no guitar transcriptions, because the guitar is a linear tinker toy compared with the saxophone and the piano and the trumpet. And so, but I'm seeing all these things that I had transcribed too. And I went, oh my God, we've all come here to New York from all these different places, and we've all been doing the same thing. And wow. And that's what that time was like. Everybody, you know, worked hard at the same stuff, but they all came to it by themselves. There was no, like I said, there's no real book to lean on. There's no nothing.
For about the last decade or so, you've dedicated yourself to, well, there's a few ways we can look at it, to becoming the preeminent guitarist in the on the Latin scene, Latin music scene. So tell us about that. And also, if that's what it is, you've decided that Latin music is where you're going to make your mark in the jazz canon, and that's why you've so focused so deeply on it for the past decade.
When you play this music, or any, you know, it doesn't have to be genre specific, but I think everybody sooner or later, and it can happen, you know, 2-3 times in your life, you know, you get smacked in the face, and you have to take a long look at yourself and see where you are, how you got to that place, and pick yourself up and keep going forward. Or you quit and you leave. I'm talking about just New York. You know, it's, a lot of guys come here and this city kicks the crap out of you and off you go. And somehow I'm still here. At a certain point, I mean, I tried really hard to have the same kind of career that the guys, you know, my brethren, my the guys I came to town with had, you know, whether it was Abercrombie or Sko, you know, we're basically, or Ralph Towner, you know, the basic thing is that what you want is maybe to be able to make a record every 18 months, and then, you know, you're touring in the middle and enjoying it, and music is growing inside you with the other players. But that just never, ever worked out for me. It wasn't that I wasn't trying. People used to say, Steve, how come I never see you playing here or there? And I said, it's not because I don't want to. It's like, I financially can't do it, because they're telling me I have to have two famous sidemen. And if I get the two famous sidemen to go play, they're still not going to guarantee enough money that makes me feel like a decent guy paying the two guys what they're worth. I mean, I'm willing to go out and play for nothing, but at least guarantee me something. So in this case, like say, if I'm playing with Dennis and Anthony, I don't want to be humiliated, you know, offering them something. Because people, you know, they tend to think like, Steve's hiding something. You know, he's taking a whole chunk of money for himself and he's paying us crap. It wouldn't be the truth at all. It isn't there. And I never had a manager, you know, a powerful, muscular manager who could just say, you're going to have Steve here and you're going to pay X amount. So it just didn't work out. And so that's why there have been these, you know, gaps. I mean, I've paid for most of these recordings out of my life savings. The only record I did that I ever saw the money come back was the solo acoustic guitar record in 1980, Evidence. Lucky for me, it only cost $6,000, and I actually got that back. That's the only time. When we get to, like, say, 2005, and I was about to record the Green Field, you know, what I was starting to realize is, like, I'm looking at the... Now, of course, a lot of time has passed since 1970, whatever. I mean, you know, from 40 years, you look at how, man, I couldn't even count them on, you know, two hands. There's so many great guitarists. And not only are they great, but they're also music makers. And for me, like, I don't like guitar music. I would never buy something because it's just great guitar playing. I like when we listen to the great players, you know, Sko or Abercrombie, Ralph Towner, Pat Metheny. It's not guitar music to me. It's just music that happens to feature the guitar. But when I hear something that's just like a bunch of guitar stuff, I don't really enjoy it. So you've got all these, and I could mention a zillion players, all these really great players, technically, you know, ridiculously great, all of them. Looking at the landscape of what there was there, and my genuine passion for Latin music, and seeing, well, the guitar is never, you know, a principal voice in Latin music. You know, it's always the trumpet or the trombone or the flute or the violin, the piano. So I saw this place. I said, if I just focus all of my energy, I can still play the same music that I love. It just goes rhythmically over to this place. And I said, I'll be all by myself. I'll be in this, there's no one else really doing this, you know, with the whole shooting match of Latin percussion. You know, some guys do it, you know, drums, and they have a conga, and they say, well, that's Latin jazz. And could be, who am I to say it isn't? But it's not the same as having timbal, conga, bongo, all the full array of sounds associated with music. And so that's kind of how I ended up in this place. And these, it was by, you know, by choice and also by passion, because I genuinely love it. And it's such a great adventure to see if what I hear in my head can work. And I know it can work on a recording. I don't know if you could take the guitar sound I'm playing with and go out and play live with the same complement of instruments and have that guitar sound cut through, unless you're in a position like, say, where almost only Pat Metheny has been these last 20 years, where he can travel with his own sound crew, his own gear every night. Most of us have been traveling around, you know, playing with amps du jour, you know, drummer playing on drums du jour. And it gets very, you know, frustrating.
Our conversation with Steve Kahn will continue in a moment.
Hi, this is Matt Slocum. You're listening to the Jazz Rocks podcast with Tom Alexander and Walter Koloski.
The latest from the Deep Energy Orchestra is called Return, featuring Jason Everett with Trey Gunn, Fareed Hawk, Phil Hershey, Selva Ganesh Vinayakram, E. Doc Smith. Fall into the world grooves of the Deep Energy Orchestra. Return is available at the Deep Energy Orchestra Band Camp page.
Yeah, you sort of predicted a question that I had, sort of the genesis of Patchwork. Obviously, we talked about the Latin music, but, you know, interpretations of works by Monk and Ornette Coleman, Keith Jarrett, and others. And that's what's really sort of the overall feel of Patchwork, the current album. So the genesis then is just the love, the desire for this music, or was there something else that led you to reimagine the music?
It's a great question. I mean, the thing is, you know, when you look at, even if you, like I said, if you, you can take pretty much all the records, everything is tied to the mid-60s, you know, the music that inspired me to play. So when you look at the composers that I've covered or interpreted, reimagined tunes by, you know, the names you mentioned, Monk, Ornette, Wayne Shorter, Joe Henderson, Herbie, McCoy, Bobby Hutcherson, Freddie Hubbard, Larry Young. I mean, the list of these great players who, you know, inspired me to play in the first place, It's endless. So the challenge first, I mean, any tune that I chose to play, it's because I love that tune, period. I mean, there's no other motivation. That's it. But to turn it into something that will feel like the tune's supposed to be, except now it's being interpreted in with Latin rhythms, and so there, you know, there's certain rules you have to try to conform to, and if you're going to break them, you know, the other guys have to you know, say that this is okay. We'll let you slide on this little thing here. You know, it takes a lot of work, but when you hear it, you know, coming together, it's very, very, you know, gratifying. And when I get mail from young people, older people, you know, all over the world, but especially Latin music fans, Latinos from all over, you know, South America, the Caribbean, Spain, and Latinos who've been kind of displaced from their countries, living in, you know, all over Europe and as far away as Australia, and they tell me about, you know, how inspiring it is to hear these records, and it gives them ideas. And the funny thing is, you know, I know pretty much, I think, like to believe, you know, all the great Latino guitar virtuosos. I'm in touch with all of them, and these guys are amazing players, completely, but none of them want to play music with their own rhythms. They all want to play, I'm sorry I use the word all, but many of them, you know, want to play like Mike Stern or something, or they want to play some kind of abstract jazz. And of course, where do you find an Elvin Jones in Peru or Argentina or someplace? I mean, listen, nobody can find an Elvin Jones here in New York. So how can you expect? I mean, this has been the age old question. It's like, where do I find another Elvin Jones? Where do I find a Jack? Where do I find a Roy Haynes? You don't, you know, and yet there have been a lot of great drummers who've come along here. It's the quest for these things. It's always the same. You know, it's like a good drummer and a good bass player. Where are they? I think they're more great bass players than say there are drummers who feel great to play with.
Yeah,
it's a tough thing.
As Steve knows, we've been extensively listening to his music lately, and one of the things that I like about the music is, even though it is obviously strong Latin underpinnings, I'd still sort of call it a fusion music. I hear blues, rock, funk, you know, there's a reference to James Brown that I really dig going way back. What album is that, from 2011?
Well, yeah, in subtext, there's a tune called Maria Mulambo.
That's the tune.
Actually, it's on Parting Shot, and yes, it's like a it's working with the Afro-Cuban 6/8, but you could combine that with I always forget the name of this particular James Brown group, but I remember talking to Dennis about it. I said, can you play this against that?
Is that Fred Wesley and the JBs? Is that who you're thinking of?
Well, no. It's a specific tune.
It's a funky good time is what the we're going to have a funky good time.
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah. I don't think that's the title of it, but it's yeah. that's the groove. And so, you know, Dennis wouldn't have heard that, but I said I hear this and this combined, and he said, yeah, I can do that. And we did a similar thing on this last record where playing Epistrophe, again, it's I love doing these different twists on Afro-Cuban 6/8. And this time I asked Dennis, I said, can we do this, but you play the Purdy Shuffle against what we're doing? And he said to me, wow, he says, yeah, I can do that. He says, no problem. That'll be great. And the thing is that we're playing, you know, this lilting on the one, if you're listening to it on one way, 6/8. But one of the things I love about Latin musicians is I don't think there's a group of players that travels back and forth between the cross currents of 6/8 and 4/4 than Latin players. They move so easily. It's effortless for them. So when we're playing Epistrophe, there are these three things going on. There's the 6/8, there's Dennis playing the Purdy Shuffle, but I'm feeling the melody as swing. Is it do-do-do-do-do-do-do? That's where I'm feeling it against that. Fascinating thing about it to me. So it's like what you're saying, it's still like jazz to me. It's just little chord changes and you're improvising and stuff. It's just there's all this complex rhythmic stuff going on.
I love how, you know, when you get into the whole construction and the deconstruction of music, and you speak with a person as, like yourself, who's been doing it their whole lives, it just is, you sort of just tap into a world that's, you know, I personally can just go hours and hours just, you know, learning about this and hearing all the great stories and about the influence. Unfortunately, it's a podcast, so we are regulated to some level of constraint in terms of timeline, but man, wow, just great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Walter. I'm really happy you invited me, and you know, this has been really fun. I mean, I love sitting around talking about music like this, and it's funny, I was talking before about how long I thought I'd be doing this when I signed with Columbia, which didn't happen exactly the way my dream world had it happening. But, you know, when you're sitting here today in 2020, after having moved to New York in 1970, you know, it's 50 years. And I think if you're still around and alive, you end up with a lot of stories to tell. What you don't realize is the guys you're hanging out with, you don't know what they're going to become or how they're going to be seen in 5 years, 10 years. And that's the amazing thing, is like, you're struggling to find yourself and do all this stuff, but 10, 15 years from now, you'll look back and say, oh geez, I used to, you know, hang out. I used to jam with that guy. And you just don't know.
Yeah. Steve, if our listeners, what's the best way for them to find out how to get your music and especially the latest patchwork?
The easiest way, the two easiest ways are obviously Amazon and iTunes. At my website, I don't really, you know, www.stevekahn.com, I don't really sell anything. All I do is, through links, you know, guide people to how to find things. So you can always use my website to do that. There are links there that'll guide you to Amazon or stuff. But I think it's pretty simple. We're living in a time where there are not a whole lot of options. And I think the saddest thing about these times is that we live in an age now where we got a couple generations, maybe, I hope it's not three, but at least two, where people feel like everything should be for free. You know, we shouldn't have to pay for anything. Yeah. And this is killing music, art, dance, you name it. It's killing everything.
Yeah. On that high note. But yeah, we continue on, don't we? I think the art will live. It depends on whether the artist will. Eat, I suppose, is the way we look at that. Yeah. We're going to play out our interview with Steve today from a tune from Patchwork called Non-Issue. Think of Indian bread.
Yummy.
My favorite cuisine, by the way. And Steve, thanks so much for being our guest on the Jazz
Walter,
Podcast.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Great to be with you and Tom. And, you know, just keep doing this. It's a great thing. Thank you.
Tom and I have been asked over and over again, when is the Jazz Rocks podcast going to be properly archived so we can go back and listen to some old shows? Well, the answer is now. You can now go to archive.org. That's archive.org. Type Jazz Rocks Podcast into the search box, and there you will find interviews with Jan Hammer, Dennis Chambers, Scott Henderson, Steve Kahn, Narda Michael Walden, and many other legendary and contemporary stars. Special features, too. That's the Jazz Rocks Podcast at archive.org.
This is John Etheridge from London, and you're listening to the Jazz Rocks podcast with Tom Alexander and Walter Kolofsky. So sit back and enjoy some really great jazz rock.
We're wrapping things up now on the Jazz Rocks podcast, along with Walter Kolofsky, Tom Alexander. And Walter, there was one thing you said in the at the top of the show that, you know, I want to just point out really quickly. You said you lived it and I did not. And you're right. You did live it and I did not. But I was alive. The only difference is while you were listening to Mahavishnu John McLaughlin, I was listening to Mahavishnu Elton John.
Well, there you go. Hey, yeah. By the way, I think we forgot to say which jazz podcast number this was.
Oh, we did?
This is jazz podcast number 23. I really want to point out to our listeners that Steve Kahn has perhaps the best musician's website on the internet. In the intro, I had mentioned that he was an educator, a teacher, a student, and he is that. He studies the great musicians and the tunes they did. Then he'll write a transcript and analyze it and put it all there on his website for you to eat up. He's done well over 100 of those. I know he does it for his own tunes as well, but he'll take many classics. They don't have to be fusion. They don't even have to be jazz. He will analyze them and put them up there. It's one of the great sites on the internet for learning about music. The guy seems to be engaged every day. And sometimes you'll get his social commentary as well, which is worth it. He spells his name different than his dad did. So it's StevKhan, SteveKhan.com.
So that's it. I mean, we've put another show to bed, so to speak, and I think we're attempting to always continue the drive to keep the music alive. That is jazz rock fusion. And even though we're sort of still all of us going through this crazy time, we need to persevere. The show must go on, as they say, Walter. I am from Miami. Walter, where are you from?
This is Walter Kolofsky from Boston.
This is the Jazz Rocks Podcast. We thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This has been the Jazz Rocks Podcast with Tom Alexander and Walter Kolofsky. Tom Alexander is a jazz musician and voiceover artist based in Miami, Florida. Walter Kolofsky is a music journalist and historian who lives just outside of Boston. The Jazz Rocks Podcast is produced by Alexander Productions. This program was recorded at Studio Alpha in Miami and can be heard on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can follow the Jazz Rocks Podcast on Twitter at Jazz Rocks PC and on Facebook at the Jazz Rock Fusion page. If you wish to advertise on the Jazz Rocks Podcast or make any inquiry of Tom or Walter, please email us at info@alexanderproductions.com.